Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook, and good morning, Bethann.
Good morning, Chris.
I wonder how many people have a more jaundiced view of their government than they did, say, a couple of months ago.
Well, a couple of months ago, well, that's not much time. You know, maybe 50 years ago, but a jaundiced look and a very long forgettery and knowing how to move things, you know, into an argument that's not just a month or a year or even a decade long, but others. And tomorrow we're asking, or not tomorrow, but today we're asking a question: in politics, how can you win by doing absolutely nothing? Well, it depends on how you define winning and the length of your horizon, which, according to political analyst Neil Milner, is exactly why we're stuck in the present gridlock and why for 60 years those big losers probably include you and me. Neil Milner joins us now for our biweekly segment, The Long View. Gridlock, you know, we're talking about the fact that not much really, really happens. And it's not a matter of just a policy or a one-off, but overall the kind of gridlock and its impact, right?
Right, yeah. Gridlock, doing nothing has great consequences. And one of the most important consequences, according to recent research, which covers almost the entire period from 1940 on in national government, is that the more gridlock there is, that is, the more filibustering there is, the less ability to pass laws, the greater the degree of income inequality. That the amount of gridlock explains an exceptionally large amount of the increase in income inequality in the United States.
And we're talking about income inequality, meaning transference of wealth?
Transfers, the amount of income that the 1% gets. Right now, that's about 25% of the income, the total income in the country. 1% has 25% of the income. That's the highest since right before the Depression. And that has a lot to do, much more than people think generally, with gridlock. So gridlock has consequences, and the consequences are that it increases the amount of income inequality.
And this is not just simply about talking of the debt ceiling or talking about keeping the government going, but this is pervasive.
This is pervasive, yes, but much of the gridlock now is very explicitly related to income issues like the debt ceiling, like the refusal to raise revenues, like the fight over cutting the budget, and do you have to cut out programs and so on. So right now you're in a period where you see this kind of relationship between gridlock and inequality playing out very explicitly.
But you're also talking about issues of taxation in there too, because that's been the big bugaboo and what no one really wants to talk about except to say no, no, no.
Well, that's right. I mean, what you have right now is very much in the tradition in the Republican Party of the very strong anti-tax movements that have been in the United States for a long time. They ebb and flow in terms of how successful they are. But the Tea Party is very much in the tradition of the kind of anti-income tax things. A recent study, focus groups, Republican focus groups, and they talked and they find that within the Republican Party, the Tea Party stands out in two things from the rest of the Republicans: in its emphasis on liberty rather than equality, and on its support for the 1%, for its belief that you shouldn't increase taxes on the 1%, and that, in fact, the job creators in the world are the 1%. So what you have now is this kind of anti-tax sentiment that's been around for a long time that has done a very good job of capturing much of the Republican Party. No more taxes has become a very binding pledge for a long time. So you see how this inequality and gridlock thing are all coming together right now.
In terms of taxing the 1%, we hear this term, you know, the fair share, and who should pay a fair share. Fair to whom and fair to what?
Well, that depends on your point of view. Again, looking at the Tea Party is not made up of rich people as a rule. They're made up of predominantly white, sort of on the older side, folks who are reasonably well off, but believe that the 1%, believe that those people deserve the wealth they get. And from their point of view, not only do they deserve it, but they, they're the ones who will save the economy.
Because and they're the rainmakers.
Because they're the rainmakers.
They're going to be the job creators, and they should get the buy when it comes to taxes.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's certainly no agreement on whether this degree of inequality is a problem. What's interesting to me is how much we've talked about inequality in a way, income inequality in a way that says it's those big forces out there that we can't control. And what the research suggests is that government can control a chunk of it, but that there are big differences over whether we should or not, and whether and whether it's a problem that we have this kind of thing.
Which sounds like this is not going to be anything that's going to change anytime soon, despite all the conversation about next year's election and the one in presidential election in 2016.
No, I don't think it's going to change very soon for a couple of reasons. First of all, the power that the safe districts and the institutional rules that allow for inertia is going to continue. The Tea Party passion, I don't care that right now there's less approval for the Tea Party. The kind of passion that they bring to politics is very powerful and will continue. Long run, and even in the 2014, you may see some of this change because it's hard to keep anti-tax sentiment together unless there's a very compelling issue of a policy threat. And it's not clear. Obamacare was pretty much off the table as a policy threat. Now it's back on, but it's still already there. But when the real challenge for anti-tax people, particularly in the Republican Party, is going to be the first time is going to be in 2016 in the presidential race, because the American electorate is pretty stable. And the American electorate doesn't buy in as a rule to one compelling issue as a mandate. So the challenge for the really passionate anti-tax people, the Tea Party people in 2016, is to be able to get a candidate across that appeals to a broader base, because that's what you need. And that's the classic fight in every political party, but certainly much more so in the Republican Party. The Romney versus the right is going to play out in 2016, and that's the ultimate challenge for the Tea Party. And remember, the Tea Party is a movement in many ways. They think like movement people, even though they've been successful in influencing the Republican Party, and compromise is very hard for them.
But when he comes back to the whole issue of the impact of gridlock long term, and this is obviously, yeah, we're just now looking at the two-year horizon, although this may be a Republican and Tea Party issue or driver this time around, it's not always been that way.
That's
but
right.
The issue of that pervasive issue of gridlock and the inertia that's gone over decades has been at times Democratic, it's
absolutely
been at times Republican. This time we're just focusing on that because that's where it happens.
That's
to
where
lie.
It happens now. Remember,
but the bottom line is that we've had, you know, 60, 70 years of inertia and gridlock.
Yes. And remember, gridlock is built into the American political system as a healthy thing, the separation of powers and so on. What's happened, though, is that it's become that, and in fact, that may increase the income inequality. What's happened right now is how much focus there is on distrust of raising revenue.
All right. We'll talk more about this in a couple of weeks. Thanks for coming back.
You're welcome.
Political analyst Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our new biweekly segment, The Long View, and he'll be back in a couple of weeks for the next installment of The Conversation.